to come up with a response. Shallan cut in before he could do so. "I'm not surprised you're at a loss for words, as it's also an experience I'm sure you're accustomed to. You must feel it every time someone asks you a challenging question, such as the color of your shirt."
"Cute," he said. "But words aren't going to change these men or the troubles they are in."
"On the contrary," Shallan said, meeting his eyes, "in my experience, words are where most change begins. I have promised them a second chance. I will keep my promise." Vatha grunted, but wandered away without further comment. Shallan sighed, sitting down and returning to her work. "That one always walks around acting like a chasm fiend ate his mother," she said with a grimace. "Or perhaps the chasm fiend was his mother."
Red laughed. "If you don't mind me saying, Brightness, you have quite the clever tongue on you."
"I've never actually had someone's tongue on me," Shallan said, turning a page and not looking up. "Clever or not, I'd hazard to consider it an unpleasant experience."
"It ain't so bad," Gaz said.
They both looked at him. He shrugged.
"Just saying, it ain't..."
Red laughed, slapping Gaz on the shoulder.
"I'm going to get some food. I'll help you hunt down that hinge afterward."
Gaz nodded, though he glanced to the side again, that same nervous tick, and didn't join Red as the taller man walked toward the dinner cauldron. Instead, he settled down to begin sanding the floor of her wagon, where the wood had begun to splinter. She set aside the notebook in front of her, in which she had been attempting to devise ways to help her brothers. These included everything from trying to buy one of the soulcasters owned by the Alethi King, to trying to track down the ghost bloods and somehow deflect their attention. She couldn't do anything, however, until she reached the Shattered Plains, and then most of her plans would require her to have powerful allies. Shallan needed to make the betrothal to Adolin Colin go forward, not just for her family, but for the good of the world. Shallan would need the allies and resources that would give her. But what if she couldn't maintain the betrothal? What if she couldn't bring Brightness Navani to her side? She might need to proceed in finding Urethiru and preparing for the Voidbringers on her own. That terrified her, but she wanted to be ready. She dug out a different book, one of the few from Yasna's stash that didn't describe the Voidbringers or legendary Urethiru. Instead, it listed the current Alethi High Princes and discussed their political maneuvers and goals. Shallan had to be ready. She had to know the political landscape of the Alethi court. She couldn't afford ignorance. She had to know who among these people might be potential allies if all else failed her. What if this Sadius, she thought, flipping to a page in the notebook. It listed him as conniving and dangerous, but noted that both he and his wife were sharp of wit. A man of intelligence might listen to Shallan's arguments and understand them. Aladar was listed as another high prince that Yasna respected. Powerful, known for his brilliant political maneuvers. He was also fond of games of chance. Perhaps he would risk an expedition to find Urethiru if Shallan highlighted the potential riches to be found. Hatham was listed as a man of delicate politics and careful planning, another potential ally. Yasna didn't think much of Thanadol, Bethab, or Sabariel. The first she called oily, the second a dullard, and the third outrageously rude. She studied them and their motivations for some time. Eventually, Gaz stood up and dusted sawdust from his trousers. He nodded in respect to her and moved to get himself some food.
"A moment, Master Gaz," she said.
"I'm no master," he said, walking up to her. "Sixth non only, Brightness. Never could buy myself anything better."
"How bad exactly are these debts of yours?" she asked, digging some spheres out of her safe pouch to put in the goblet on her desk.
"Well, one of the fellows I owed was executed.
Gaz said, rubbing his chin. But there is more, he hesitated. 80 ruby bromes, Brightness. Though they might not take them any more. It's my head they may want these days.
Quite a debt for a man such as yourself. Are you a gambler, then?
Ain't no difference, he said. Sure.
And that's a lie, Shallan said, cocking her head. I would know the truth from you, Gaz.
Just turn me over to them, he said, turning and walking toward the soup. Ain't no matter. I'd rather that than be out here, wondering when they'll find me anyways.
Shallan watched him go, then shook her head, turning back to her studies. She says that Urethiro is not on the Shattered Plains, Shallan thought, turning a few pages. But how is she certain? The plains were never fully explored because of the chasms. Who knows what is out there? Fortunately, Asna was very complete in her notes. It appeared that most of the old records spoke of Urethiro as being in the mountains. The Shattered Plains filled a basin. No Adon could walk there, Shallan thought, flipping to a quote from The Way of Kings. Yasna questioned the validity of that statement, though Yasna questioned pretty much everything. After an hour of study as the sun sank down through the sky, Shallan found herself rubbing her temples.
Are you well?
Pattern's voice asked softly. He liked to come out when it was darker, and she did not forbid him. She searched and found him on the table, a complex formation of ridges in the wood. Historians, Shallan said, are a bunch of liars. Pattern said, sounding satisfied. That wasn't a compliment.
Oh.
Shallan slammed her current book closed. These women were supposed to be scholars. Instead of recording facts, they wrote opinions and presented them as truth. They seem to take great pains to contradict one another, and they dance around topics of import like spren around a fire, never providing heat themselves, just making a show of it. Pattern hummed.
Truth is individual.
What? No, it's not. Truth is... it's truth. Reality.
Your truth is what you see, Pattern said, sounding confused. What else could it be? That is the truth that you spoke to me. The truth that brings power.
She looked at him, his ridges casting shadows in the light of her spheres. She'd renewed those in the high storm last night, while she was cooped up in her box of a wagon. Pattern had started buzzing in the middle of the storm, a strange, angry sound. After that, he'd ranted in a language she didn't understand, panicking Gaz and the other soldiers she'd invited into the shelter. Luckily, they took it for granted that terrible things happened during high storms, and none had spoken of it since. Fool, she told herself, flipping to an empty page in the notes. Start acting like a scholar. Yasna would be disappointed. She wrote down what Pattern had said just now. Pattern, she said, tapping her pencil, one she'd gotten from the merchants along with paper. This table has four legs. Would you not say that is a truth, independent of my perspective? Pattern buzzed uncertainly.
What is a leg? Only as it is defined by you. Without a perspective, there is no such thing as a leg or a table. There is only wood.
You've told me the table perceives itself this way.
Because people have considered it long enough as being a table, Pattern said. It becomes truth to the table because of the truth the people create for it.
Interesting, Shallan thought, scribbling away at her notebook. She wasn't so interested in the nature of truth at the moment, but in how Pattern perceived it. Is this because he's from the cognitive realm? The books say that the spiritual realm is a place of pure truth,
while the cognitive is more fluid.
Spren, Shallan said. If people weren't here, would Spren have thought?
Not here in this realm, Pattern said. I do not know about the other realm.
You don't sound concerned, Shallan said. Your entire existence might be dependent on people.
It is, Pattern said, again unconcerned. But children are dependent upon parents.
He hesitated.
Besides, there are others who think.
Voidbringers, Shallan said, cold.
Yes. I do not think that my kind would live in a world with only them. They have their own Spren.
Shallan sat up sharply. Their own Spren? Pattern shrank on her table, scrunching up, his ridges growing less distinct as they mashed together. Well? Shallan asked.
We do not speak of this.
You might want to start, Shallan said. It's important. Pattern buzzed. She thought he was going to insist on the point, but after a moment he continued in a very small voice.
Spren are power. Shattered power. Power given thought by the perceptions of men. Honor, cultivation, and another. Fragments broken off.
Another? Shallan prodded. Pattern's buzz became a whine, going so high-pitched she almost couldn't hear it.
Odium!
He spoke the word as if needing to force it out. Shallan wrote furiously. Odium. Hatred. A type of Spren? Perhaps a large, unique one, like Kusisesh from Eerie or the Night Watcher. Hatred Spren. She'd never heard of such a thing. As she wrote, one of her slaves approached in the darkening night. The timid man wore a simple tunic and trousers, one of the sets given to Shallan by the merchants. The gift was welcome, as the last of Shallan's spheres were in the goblet before her, and wouldn't be enough to buy a meal at some of the finer restaurants in Carbranth.
Brightness? The man asked.
Yes, Suna?
He pointed. The other lady, she asked me to tell you.
He was pointing toward the tent used by Tin, the tall woman who was leader of the few remaining caravan guards. She wants me to visit her? Shallan asked.
Yes.
Suna said, looking down.
For food, I guess.
Thank you, Suna, Shallan said, freeing him to go back toward the fire, where he and the other slaves were helping with the cooking, while Parshman gathered wood. Shallan's slaves were a quiet group. They had tattoos on their foreheads rather than brands. It was the kinder way to do it, and usually marked a person who had entered servitude willingly, as opposed to being forced into it as a punishment for a violent or terrible crime. They were men with debts, or the children of slaves who still bore the debt of their parents. They were accustomed to labor, and seemed frightened by the idea of what she was paying them. Pittance though it was, it would see most of them freed in under 2 years. They were obviously uncomfortable with that idea. Shallan shook her head, packing away her things. As she walked toward Tin's tent, Shallan paused at the fire and asked Red to lift her table back into the wagon and secure it there. She did worry about her things, but she no longer kept any spheres in there, and had left it open so Red and Gaz could glimpse inside and see only books. Hopefully there would be no incentive for people to go rooting through them. You dance around the truth, too, she thought to herself as she walked away from the fire. Just like those historians you were ranting about. She pretended these men were heroes, but had no illusions about how quickly they could change coats in the wrong circumstances. Tin's tent was large and well lit. The woman didn't travel like a simple guard.
In many ways, she was the most intriguing person here. One of the few light eyes aside from the merchants themselves. A woman who wore a sword. Shallan peeked in through the open flaps and found several parshmen setting up a meal on a low travel table, meant for people to eat at while sitting on the floor. The parshmen hurried out, and Shallan watched them suspiciously. Tin herself stood by a window cut into the cloth. She wore her long tan coat, buckled at the waist and almost closed. It had a dress-like feel to it, though it was far stiffer than any dress Shallan had worn, matched by the stiff trousers the woman wore underneath.
"I asked your men," Tin said without turning, "and they said you hadn't dined yet. I had the parshmen bring enough for two."
"Thank you," Shallan said, entering and trying to keep the hesitation from her voice. Among these people, she wasn't a timid girl, but a powerful woman, theoretically.
"I've ordered my people to keep the perimeter clear," Tin said. "We can speak freely."
"That is well," Shallan said.
"It means," Tin said, turning around, "that you can tell me who you really are."
"Stormfather? What did that mean?" "I'm Shallan Devar, as I have said."
"Yes," Tin said, walking over and sitting down at the table. "Please," she said, gesturing.
Shallan seated herself carefully, using a ladylike posture, with legs bent to the side. Tin sat cross-legged after flipping her coat out behind her. She dug into her meal, dipping flat bread in a curry that seemed too dark and smelled too peppery to be feminine.
"Men's food?" Shallan asked. "I've always hated those definitions," Tin said. "I was raised in Tubela by parents who worked as interpreters. I didn't realize certain foods were supposed to be for women or men until I visited my parents' homeland for the first time. Still seems stupid to me. I'll eat what I want, thank you very much."
Shallan's own meal was more proper, smelling sweet rather than savory. She ate, only now realizing how hungry she was.
"I have a span reed," Tin said.
Shallan looked up, tip of her bread in her dipping bowl.
"It's connected to one over in Tashik," Tin continued, "at one of their new information houses. You hire an intermediary there and they can perform services for you. Research, make inquiries, even relay messages for you via span reed to any major city in the world. Quite spectacular."
"That sounds useful," Shallan said carefully.
"Indeed. You can find out all kinds of things. For example, I had my contact find out what they could on House Devar. It's apparently a small, out-of-the-way house with large debts and an erratic house leader who may or may not still be alive. He has a daughter, Shallan, whom nobody seems to have met."
"I am that daughter," Shallan said. "So I'd say that nobody is a stretch."
"And why," Tin said, "would an unknown scion of a minor Vaden family be traveling the Frostlands with a group of slavers, all the while claiming she's expected at the Shattered Plains, and that her rescue will be celebrated, that she has powerful connections, enough to pay the salaries of a full mercenary troop?"
"Truth is sometimes more surprising than a lie."
Tin smiled, then leaned forward. "It's all right. You don't need to keep up the front with me. You're actually doing a good job here. I've discarded my annoyance with you and have decided to be impressed instead. You're new to this, but talented."
"This?" Shallan asked.
"The art of the con, of course," Tin said. "The grand act of pretending to be someone you aren't and running off with the goods. I like what you pulled with those deserters. It was a big gamble, and it paid off. But now you're in a predicament. You're pretending to be someone several steps above your station, and are promising a grand payoff. I've run that scam before, and the trickiest part is the end. If you don't handle this well, these heroes you've recruited will have no qualms stringing you up by the neck. I've noticed that you're dragging your feet moving us toward the plains. You're uncertain, aren't you? In over your head?"
"Most definitely," Shallan said softly.
"Well,"
Tin said, digging into her food. I'm here to help.
At what cost?
This woman certainly did like to talk. Shallan was inclined to let her continue.
I want in on whatever you're planning, Tin said, stabbing her bread down into the bowl like a sword into a great shell.
You came all the way here to the Frostlands for something. Your plot is likely no small con, but I can't help but assume you don't have the experience to pull it off.
Shallan tapped her finger against the table. Who would she be for this woman? Who did she need to be?
She seems like a master con artist, Shallan thought, sweating. I can't fool someone like this.
Except that she already had. Accidentally. How did you end up here? Shallan asked.
Leading guards on a caravan? Is that part of a con?
Tin laughed.
This? No, it wouldn't be worth the trouble. I may have exaggerated my experience in talking to the caravan leaders, but I needed to get to the Shattered Plains and didn't have the resources to do it on my own. Not safely.
How does a woman like you end up without resources, though? Shallan asked, frowning.
I'd think you would never be without. I'm not, Tin said, gesturing. As you can plainly see. You're going to have to get used to rebuilding if you want to join the profession. It comes, it goes. I got stuck down south without any spheres, and am finding my way to more civilized countries.
To the Shattered Plains, Shallan said.
You have a job there of some sort as well? A con you're intending to pull?
Tin smiled.
This isn't about me, kid. It's about you. And what I can do for you. I know people in the war camps. It's practically the new capital of Alethkar. Everything interesting in the country is happening there. Money is flowing like rivers after a storm. But everyone considers it a frontier, and so laws are lax. A woman can get ahead if she knows the right people.
Tin leaned forward, and her expression darkened.
But if she doesn't, she can make enemies really quickly. Trust me. You want to know who I know, and you want to work with them. Without their approval, nothing big happens at the Shattered Plains. So I ask you again. What are you hoping to accomplish there?
I know something about Dalinar Kholin.
Old Blackthorn himself? Tin said, surprised. He's been living a boring life lately. All superior, like he's some hero from the legends.
Yes. Well, what I know is going to be very important to him. Very.
Well, what is this secret?
Shallan didn't answer.
Not willing to divulge the goods yet, Tin said. Well, that's understandable. Blackmail is a tricky one. You'll be glad you brought me on. You are bringing me on, aren't you?
Yes, Shallan said. I do believe I could learn some things from you.
25. Monsters. Smoke form for hiding and slipping between men. A form of power, like human surges. Bring it round again. Though crafted of gods, it was by unmade hand. Leaves its force to be but one of foe or friend. From the Listener's Song of Histories, 127th stanza. Kaladin figured that it took a lot to put him in a situation he'd never before seen. He'd been a slave and a surgeon, served on a battlefield and in a light-eyes dining room. He'd seen a lot for his 20 years. Too much, it felt at times. He had many memories he'd rather be without. Regardless, he had not expected this day to present him with something so utterly and disconcertingly unfamiliar. "Sir?" he asked, taking a step backward. "You want me to do what?" "Get on that horse," Dalinar Kholin said, pointing toward an animal grazing nearby. The beast would stand perfectly still, waiting for grass to creep up out of its holes. Then it would pounce, taking a quick bite, which would cause the grass to shoot back down into its burrows. It got a mouthful each time, often pulling the grass out by its roots. It was one of many such animals, dawdling and prancing through the area. It never ceased to stun Kaladin just how rich people like Dalinar were. Each horse was worth spheres in profusion, and Dalinar wanted him to climb on one of them. "Soldier," Dalinar said, "you need to know how to ride. The time might come when you need to guard my sons on the battlefield. Besides, how long did it take you to reach the palace the other night when coming to hear about the king's accident?" "Almost 3/4 of an hour," Kaladin admitted. It had been 4 days since that night, and Kaladin had frequently found himself on edge since then. "I have stables near the barracks," Dalinar said. "You could have made that trip in a fraction of the time if you could ride. Perhaps you won't spend much of your time in the saddle, but this is going to be an important skill for you and your men to know." Kaladin looked back at the other members of Bridge Four. Shrugs all around, a few timid ones, except for Moash, who nodded eagerly. "I suppose," Kaladin said, looking back at Dalinar. "If you think it's important, sir, we'll give it a try." "Good man," Dalinar said. "I'll send over Yennet, the stable master." "We'll await him with eagerness, sir," Kaladin said, trying to sound like he meant it. Two of Kaladin's men escorted Dalinar as he walked toward the stables, a set of large, sturdy stone buildings. From what Kaladin saw, when the horses weren't inside, they were allowed to roam freely inside this open area west of the war camp. A low stone wall enclosed it, but surely the horses could jump that at will. They didn't. The brutes wandered about, stalking grass or lying down, snorting and whinnying. The entire place smelled strange to Kaladin. Not of dung, just of horse. Kaladin eyed one eating nearby, just inside the wall. He didn't trust it. There was something too smart about horses. Proper beasts of burden like Chawls were slow and docile. He'd ride a Chawl. A creature like this, though, who knew what it was thinking? Moash stepped up beside him, watching Dalinar go. "You like him, don't you?" he asked softly. "He's a good commander," Kaladin said, as he instinctively sought out Adolin and Renarin, who were riding their horses nearby. Apparently, the things needed to be exercised periodically to keep them functioning properly. Devilish creatures. "Don't get too close to him, Cal," Moash said, still watching Dalinar. "And don't trust him too far. He's light-eyed, remember?" "I'm not likely to forget," Kaladin said dryly. "Besides, you're the one who looked like you'd faint from joy the moment he offered to let us ride these monsters." "Have you ever faced a light-eyes riding one of these things?" Moash asked. "On the battlefield, I mean." Kaladin remembered Thundering Hooves, a man in silvery armor. Dead friends. "Yes." "Then you know the advantage it offers," Moash said. "I'll take Dalinar's offer gladly." The stablemaster turned out to be a she. Kaladin raised an eyebrow as the pretty young light-eyed woman walked up to them, a pair of grooms in tow. She wore a traditional Vorin gown, though it wasn't silk, but something coarser, and was slit up the front and back, ankle to thigh. Underneath, she wore a feminine pair of trousers. The woman wore her dark hair in a tail, no ornaments, and had a tautness to her face that he didn't expect in a light-eyed woman.
"The High Prince says I'm to let you ruffians touch my horses," Yennet said, folding her arms. "I'm not pleased about it."
"Fortunately," Kaladin said, "neither are we." She looked him up and down.
"You're that one, aren't you? The one everyone is talking about?"
"Maybe," she sniffed.
"You need a haircut." "All right, listen up, soldier boys. We're going to do this properly. I won't have you hurting my horses, all right?" You listen, and you listen well."
What proceeded was one of the dullest, most protracted lectures of Kaladin's life. The woman went on and on about posture, straight-backed but not too tense, about getting the horses to move, nudges with the heels, nothing too sharp, about how to ride, how to respect the animal, how to hold the reins properly, and how to balance, all before being allowed to even touch one of the creatures. Eventually, the boredom was interrupted by the arrival of a man on horseback. Unfortunately, it was Adolin Colin, riding that white monster of a horse of his. It was several hands taller than the one Yannette was showing them. Adolin's almost looked a completely different species, with those massive hooves, glistening white coat, and unfathomable eyes. Adolin looked the bridgeman over with a smirk, then caught the stablemaster's eye and smiled in a less condescending way. "Yannette," he said, "looking fetching today, as always. Is that a new riding dress?" The woman bent down without looking. She was now talking about how to guide the horses, and selected a stone from the ground. Then she turned and threw it at Adolin. The princeling flinched, raising an arm protectively over his face, though Yannette's aim was off. "Oh, come on now," Adolin said. "You're not still sore that—" Another rock. This one clipped him on the arm. "Right then," Adolin said, jogging his horse away, hunched down to present a smaller target for rocks. Eventually, after demonstrating saddling and bridling on her horse, Yannette finished the lecture and deemed them worthy of touching some horses. A flock of her grooms, both male and female, scurried out onto the field to select proper mounts for the six bridgemen. "Lots of women on your staff," Kaladin noted to Yannette as the grooms worked. "Horseback riding isn't mentioned in Arts and Majesty," she replied. "Horses weren't terribly well known back then. Radiance had Rashadium, but even kings had little access to ordinary horses." She wore her safe hand in a sleeve, unlike most of the dark-eyed groom women who wore gloves. "Which matters because," Kaladin said. Frowning, she looked at him, baffled. "Arts and Majesty?" she prompted. "Foundation of masculine and feminine arts? Of course, I keep looking at those captain's knots on your shoulder, but I'm just an ignorant dark eyes." "Sure, if that's how you want to put it. Whatever. Look, I'm not going to give you a lecture on the arts. I'm tired of talking to you people already. Let's just say that anyone who wants can be a groom, all right?" She lacked a polished refinement that Kaladin had come to expect in light-eyed women, and he found it refreshing. Better a woman who was overtly condescending than the alternative. The grooms walked the horses out of their enclosure and to a riding ground, shaped like a ring. A group of parshmen with eyes downcast brought the saddles, saddle pads, and bridles, equipment that, following Yennet's lecture, Kaladin could name. Kaladin selected a beast that didn't look too evil, a shorter horse with a shaggy mane and a brown coat. He saddled it with help from a groom. Nearby, Moash finished and threw himself up into his saddle. Once the groom let go, Moash's horse wandered off without him asking it to do so. "Hey," Moash said. "Stop! Whoa! How do I get it to stop walking?" "You dropped the reins," Yennet called after him. "Storming fool! Were you even listening?" "Reins?" Moash said, scrambling for them. "Can't I just slap it over the head with a reed like you do a chull?" Yennet rubbed her forehead. Kaladin looked into the eye of his own chosen beast. "Look," he said softly. "You don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. Let's just be pleasant to one another and get it over with as quickly as possible." The horse snorted softly. Kaladin took a deep breath, then grabbed the saddle as instructed, lifting one foot into the stirrup. He rocked a few times, then threw himself up into the saddle. He grabbed the saddle horn in a death grip and held on tight, ready to be thrown about as the beast went charging away. His horse bent her head and began licking some rocks. "Hey now," Kaladin said, raising the reins. "Come on, let's move." The horse ignored him. Kaladin tried cueing it in the flanks as he'd been told. The horse didn't budge. "You're supposed to be some kind of wagon with legs," Kaladin said to the thing. "You're worth more than a village. Prove it to me. Get going. Forward. Onward." The horse licked the rocks. "What is the thing doing?" Kaladin thought, leaning to the side. With surprise, he noticed grass poking out of its holes. Licking fools the grass into thinking rain has come. Often after a storm, plants would unfold to glut themselves on the water, even if insects decided to chew them. Clever beast. Lazy, but clever. "You need to show her you're in charge," Yennet said, wandering past. "Tighten the reins, sit up straight, pull her head up, and don't let her eat. She'll walk all over you if you aren't firm." Kaladin tried to obey, and did manage, finally, to pull the horse away from her meal. The horse did smell odd, but it wasn't a bad smell, really. He got her walking, and once that happened, steering wasn't that difficult. It felt strange to have some other thing in control of where he was going, however. Yes, he had the reins, but at any time this horse could just up and take off running, and he'd be unable to do anything about it. Half of Yennet's training had been about not spooking the horses, about remaining still if one started to gallop, and about never surprising one from behind. It looked higher from atop the horse than he'd assumed it would. That was a long fall to the ground. He guided the horse about, and after a short time he managed to pull up beside Natim on purpose. The long-faced bridgeman held his reins as if they were precious gemstones, afraid to yank them or direct his horse.
"Can't believe people ride these things on storming purpose," Natim said.
He had a rural Alethi accent, his words bluntly clipped, like he was biting them off before he'd quite finished them.
"I mean, we ain't moving any faster than walking, right?"
Again, Kaladin remembered the image of that charging mounted shardbearer from long ago. Yes, Kaladin could see the reason for horses. Sitting up higher made it easier to strike with power, and the size of the horse, its bulk and momentum, frightened soldiers on foot and sent them scattering. "I think most go faster than these," Kaladin said. "I'd bet they gave us the old horses to practice on."
"Yeah, I suppose," Natim said. "It's warm. Didn't expect that. I've ridden chulls before. This thing shouldn't be so warm. Hard to feel like this thing is worth as much as it is. It's like I'm riding about in a pile of emerald bromes."
He hesitated, glancing backward.
"Only emerald's backsides ain't nearly so busy."
"Natim," Kaladin asked, "do you remember much about the day when someone tried to kill the king?"
"Oh, sure," Natim said. "I was with the guys who ran out there and found him flapping in the wind like the Stormfather's own ears."
Kaladin smiled. Once this man would barely say two sentences together, instead always staring at the ground, somber, used up by his time as a bridgeman. These last few weeks had been good for Natim. Good for them all. "Before the storm that night," Kaladin said, "was anyone out on the balcony? Any servants you didn't recognize? Any soldiers who weren't from the king's guard?"
"No servants that I recall,"
Natim said, squinting. The once farmer got a pensive look on his face.
"I guarded the king all day, sir, with the king's guard. Ain't nothing standing out to me. I..." "Whoa!"
His horse had suddenly picked up speed, outpacing Kaladin's. "Think about it," Kaladin called to him. "See what you can remember." Natim nodded, still holding his reins like they were glass, refusing to pull them tight or steer the horse. Kaladin shook his head. A small horse galloped past him, in the air, made of light. Syl giggled, changing shape and spinning around as a ribbon of light before settling on the neck of Kaladin's horse, just in front of him. She lounged back, grinning, then frowned at his expression.
"You're not enjoying yourself," Syl said.
"You're starting to sound a lot like my mother."
"Captivating," Syl said. "Amazing, witty, meaningful."
"Repetitive."
"Captivating," Syl said. "Amazing, witty, meaningful."
"Very funny,"
says the man not laughing, she replied, folding her arms. All right, so what is drearifying you today?
Drearifying? Kaladin frowned. Is that a word?
You don't know?
He shook his head.
Yes,
Syl said solemnly.
Yes, it absolutely is.
Something's off, he said, about the conversation I just had with Natum. He tugged on the reins, stopping the horse from trying to bend down and nibble at grass again. The thing was very focused.
What did you talk about?
The assassination attempt, Kaladin said, narrowing his eyes. And if he'd seen anyone before the... He paused.
Before the storm.
He looked down and met Syl's eyes. The storm itself would have blown down the railing, Kaladin said.
Bending it,
Syl said, standing up and grinning.
Oh!
It was cut clean through. The mortar on the bottom chipped away, Kaladin continued. I'll bet the force of the winds was easily equal to the weight the king put on it.
So the sabotage must have happened after the storm, Syl said.
A much narrower time frame. Kaladin turned his horse toward where Natum was riding. Unfortunately, catching up wasn't easy. Natum was moving at a trot, much to his obvious dismay, and Kaladin couldn't get his mount to go faster.
Having trouble, bridge boy?
Adolin asked, trotting up. Kaladin glanced at the princeling. Stormfather, but it was difficult not to feel tiny when riding beside that monster of Adolin's. Kaladin tried to kick his horse faster. She kept clopping along at her one speed, walking around the circle here that was a kind of running track for horses.
Spray might have been fast during her youth,
Adolin said, nodding at Kaladin's mount.
But that was 15 years ago. I'm surprised she's still around, honestly. But she seems perfectly suited for training children. And bridgemen.
Kaladin ignored him, eyes forward, still trying to get the horse to pick up her pace and catch Natum.
Now, if you want something with more spunk, Adolin said, pointing toward the side, Dreamstorm over there might be more to your liking.
He indicated a larger, leaner animal in its own enclosure, saddled and roped to a pole firmly mortared into a hole in the ground. The long rope let it run in short bursts, though only around in a circle. It tossed its head, snorting. Adolin heeled his own animal forward and passed Natum.
Dreamstorm, eh? Kaladin thought, inspecting the creature.
It certainly did seem to have more spunk than Spray. It also looked like it wanted to take a bite out of anyone who drew too close. Kaladin turned Spray in that direction. Once near, he slowed. Spray was all too happy to do that, and climbed off. Doing so proved more difficult than he'd expected, but he managed to avoid tripping onto his face. Once down, he put his hands on his hips and inspected the running horse inside its fence.
"Weren't you just complaining," Syl said, walking up onto Spray's head, "that you'd rather walk than let a horse carry you about?"
"Yeah," Kaladin said.
He hadn't realized it, but he had been holding some stormlight. Just a tad. It escaped when he spoke, invisible unless he looked closely and detected a slight warping of the air.
"So what are you doing thinking about riding that?"
"This horse," he said, nodding to Spray, "is only for walking. I can walk just fine on my own. That other one, that's an animal for war."
Moash was right. Horses were an advantage on the battlefield, so Kaladin should be at least familiar with them.
"The same argument Zael made to me about learning to fight against a shardblade," Kaladin thought with discomfort, "and I turned him down."
"What do you think you're doing?"
Yennet asked, riding up to him.
"I'm going to get on that,"
Kaladin said, pointing at Dreamstorm. Yennet snorted.
"She'll throw you in a heartbeat and you'll break your crown, bridgeman. She's not good with riders." "She has a saddle on, so she can get used to wearing one."
The horse finished a round of cantering and slowed.
"I don't like that look in your eyes," Yennet told him, turning her own animal to the side.
It stomped impatiently, as if eager to be running. I'm going to give it a try, Kaladin said, walking forward. You won't even be able to get on, Yennet said. She watched him carefully, as if curious what he'd do, though it seemed to him she might be more worried for the horse's safety than his. Syl alighted on Kaladin's shoulder as he walked. This is going to be like back at the Light-Eyed practice grounds, isn't it? Kaladin asked. I'm going to end up on my back, staring at the sky, feeling like a fool.
Probably, Syl said lightly. So why are you doing this? Because of Adolin?
Nah, Kaladin said. The princeling can storm away.
Then why?
Because I'm scared of these things. Syl looked at him, seeming baffled, but it made perfect sense to Kaladin. Ahead, Dreamstorm, huffing out huge breaths from her run, looked at him. She met his eyes. Storms! Adolin's voice called from behind. Bridge boy! Don't actually do it! Are you mad? Kaladin stepped up to the horse. She danced a few steps back, but let him touch the saddle. So he breathed in a little more stormlight and threw himself at the saddle.
Damnation! What?
Adolin shouted. That was all Kaladin heard. His stormlight-aided leap let him get higher than an ordinary man could probably have managed, but his aim was off. He got hold of the pommel and threw one leg over, but the horse started thrashing. The beast was incredibly strong, a distinct and powerful contrast to Spray. Kaladin was quite nearly hurled from the seat on the first buck. With a wild swipe of the hand, Kaladin poured Stormlight onto the saddle and stuck himself in place. That only meant that instead of being tossed from horseback like a limp cloth, he got whipped back and forth like a limp cloth. He somehow managed to get hold of the horse's mane and, with teeth gritted, did his best to keep from being bounced senseless. The stable grounds were a blur. The only sounds he could hear were his beating heart and the smashing hooves. The Voidbringer beast moved like a storm itself, but Kaladin was stuck to the saddle as surely as if he'd been nailed there. After what seemed an eternity, the horse, blowing out big frothy breaths, stilled. Kaladin's swimming vision cleared to show a group of bridgemen, keeping their distance, cheering him on. Adolin and Yennet, both mounted, stared at him with what seemed to be a mixture of horror and awe. Kaladin grinned. Then, in one last powerful motion, Dreamstorm bucked him free. He hadn't realized that the stormlight in the saddle was exhausted. In a fitting fulfillment of his earlier prediction, Kaladin found himself dazed, lying on his back, staring at the sky, having trouble remembering the last few seconds of his life. A number of painspren wiggled out of the ground beside him, like orange hands that grabbed this way and that. An equine head with unfathomably dark eyes leaned down over Kaladin. The horse snorted at him. The smell was moist and grassy.
You monster, Kaladin said. You waited until I was relaxed, then drew me.
The horse snorted again, and Kaladin found himself laughing.
Storms, but that had felt good.
He couldn't explain why, but the act of clinging for dear life to the thrashing animal had been truly exhilarating. As Kaladin stood and dusted himself off, Dalinar himself broke through the crowd, brow furrowed. Kaladin hadn't realized the High Prince had still been nearby. He looked from Dreamstorm to Kaladin, then raised an eyebrow.
You don't chase down assassins on a placid mount, sir, Kaladin said, saluting. Yes, Dalinar said. But it is customary to start training men by using weapons without edges, soldier. Are you all right?
Fine, sir, Kaladin said.
Well, it seems your men are taking to the training, Dalinar said. I'm going to put in a requisition release. You and five others you select are to come here and practice every day for the next few weeks.
Yes, sir.
He'd find the time. Somehow.
Good, Dalinar said. I received your proposal for initial patrols outside of the war camps and thought it looked good. Why don't you start in 2 weeks, and bring some horses with you to practice out in the field?
Yennet made a strangled sound.
Outside the city, Bright Lord, but...
Bandits!
The horses are here to be used, Yennet, Dalinar said. Captain, you'll be sure to bring enough troops to protect the horses, won't you?
Yes, sir,
Kaladin said. Good. But do leave that one behind, Dalinar said, waving toward Dreamstorm.
Yes, sir.
Dalinar nodded, moving off and raising his hand toward someone Kaladin couldn't see. Kaladin rubbed his elbow, which he'd smacked. The remaining stormlight in his body had healed his head first, then run out before getting to his arm. Bridge Four moved to their horses as Yennet called out for them to remount and start a second phase of training. Kaladin found himself standing near Adolin, who remained mounted.
Thanks, Adolin said grudgingly.
Four? Kaladin asked, walking past him towards Spray, who continued to chew at grass, uncaring of the fuss.
Not telling Father I put you up to that.
I'm not an idiot, Adolin, Kaladin said, swinging into his saddle. I could see what I was getting myself into. He turned his horse away from her meal with some difficulty, and got some more pointers from a groom. Eventually, Kaladin trotted over toward Natum again. The gait was bouncy, but he mostly got the hang of moving with the horse, they called it posting, to keep from slapping around too much. Natum watched him as he moved up.
That's unfair, sir.
What I did with Dreamstorm?
No. The way you just ride like that. Seems so natural for you.
Didn't feel that way. I want to talk some more about that night.
Sir?
The long-faced man asked.
I haven't thought of anything yet. Been a little distracted.
I have another question, Kaladin said, bringing their horses up beside one another. I asked you about your shift during the day, but what about right after I left? Did anyone other than the king go out onto the balcony?
Just guards, sir, Natum said.
Tell me which ones, Kaladin said. Maybe they saw something. Natum shrugged.
I mainly watched the door. The king remained in the sitting room for a time. I guess Moash went out.
Moash, Kaladin said, frowning. Wasn't his shift supposed to be done soon?
Yeah,
Natum said.
He stayed around a little extra time. Said he wanted to see the king settled. While waiting, Moash went out to watch the balcony. You usually want one of us out there.
Thanks, Kaladin said. I'll ask him. Kaladin found Moash diligently listening to Yennet explain something. Moash seemed to have picked up riding quickly. He seemed to pick up everything quickly. Certainly he'd been the best student among the bridgemen when it came to fighting. Kaladin watched him for a few moments, frowning. Then it struck him. What are you thinking? That Moash might have had something to do with the assassination attempt? Don't be stupid. That was ridiculous. Besides, the man didn't have a shard blade. Kaladin turned his horse away. As he did, however, he saw the person Dalinar had gone to meet. Bright Lord Amaram. The two were too far away for Kaladin to hear them, but he could see the amusement on Dalinar's face. Adolin and Renarin rode up to them, smiling broadly as Amaram waved to them. The anger that surged within Kaladin, sudden, passionate, almost chokingly strong, made him clench his fists. His breath hissed out. That surprised him. He'd thought the hatred buried deeper than that. He turned his horse pointedly the other direction, suddenly looking forward to the chance to go on patrol with the new recruits. Getting away from the war camps sounded very good to him. 26. The Feather.
They blame our people for the loss of that land. The city that once covered it did range the eastern strand. The power made known in the tomes of our clan, our gods were not who shattered these plains. From the Listener Song of Wars, 55th Stanza.
Adolin crashed into the Barshendi line, ignoring weapons, throwing his shoulder against the enemy at the front. The Barshendi man grunted, his song faltering as Adolin spun about himself
and swept with his shard blade. Tugs on the weapon marked when it passed through flesh. Adolin came out of his spin, ignoring the glow of stormlight coming from a crack at his shoulder. Around him, bodies dropped, eyes burning in their skulls. Adolin's breath, hot and humid, filled his helm as he puffed in and out. There, he thought, raising his blade and charging, his men filling in around him. Not those bridgemen for once, but real soldiers. He'd left the bridgemen back on the assault plateau. He didn't want men around him who didn't want to fight Parshendi. Adolin and his soldiers pushed through the Parshendi, joining up with a frantic set of soldiers in green uniforms with gold accents, led by a shard-bearer in matching colors. The man fought with a large shard-bearer's hammer. He had no blade of his own. Adolin pushed through to him.
Yakimov, he asked. You all right?
All right,
Yakimov asked, voice muffled by his helm. He slammed the faceplate up, revealing a grin.
I'm wonderful.
He laughed, pale green eyes alight with the thrill of the fight. Adolin recognized that feeling well.
You were almost surrounded, Adolin said, turning to face a group of Parshendi running up in pairs.
Adolin respected them for coming at shard-bearers rather than fleeing. It meant almost certain death, but if you won, you could turn the tide of a battle. Yakimov laughed, sounding as pleased now as when enjoying a winehouse singer, and that laughter was infectious. Adolin found himself grinning as he engaged the Parshendi, sweeping them down with blow after blow. He never enjoyed simple warfare as much as a good duel, but for the moment, despite its crassness, he found challenge and joy in the fight. Moments later, the dead lying at his feet, he spun about and searched for another challenge. This plateau was shaped very strangely. It had been a tall hill before the plains were shattered, but half of it had ended up on the adjacent plateau. He couldn't imagine what kind of force would have split the hill down the center, as opposed to cracking it at the base. Well, it wasn't an ordinary shaped hill, so maybe that had something to do with the split. It was shaped more like a wide, flat pyramid, with only three steps. A large base, a second plateau atop it that was perhaps 100 feet across, then a third, smaller peak atop the other two, placed right in the center. Almost like a cake with three tiers that had been cut with a large knife right down the center. Adolin and Yakimov fought on the second tier of the battlefield. Technically, Adolin wasn't required to be on this run. It wasn't his army's turn in the rotation. However, the time had come to implement another part of Dalinar's plan. Adolin had arrived with only a small strike force, but it was a good thing he had. Yakimov had been surrounded up here, on the second tier, and the regular army hadn't been able to break through. Now the Parshendi had been pushed back to the sides of this tier. They still held the top tier completely. It was where the chrysalis had appeared. That put them in a bad position. Yes, they had the high ground, but they also had to hold the slopes between tiers to secure their withdrawal. They'd obviously hoped to get the harvesting done before the humans arrived. Adolin kicked a Parshendi soldier over the edge, toppling him down 30 feet or so onto those fighting on the bottom tier, then looked to his right. The slope upward was there, but the Parshendi had the approach clogged. He'd really like to reach the top. He looked at the sheer cliff face between his tier and the one above.
Yakimov, he called, pointing.
Yakimov followed Adolin's gesture, looking upward, then stepped back from the fighting.
That's crazy,
Yakimov said as Adolin jogged up.
Sure is. Let's be at it, then.
He handed his hammer to Adolin, who slipped it into the sheath on his friend's back. Then the two of them ran to the rock wall and started to climb. Adolin's plated fingers ground against rock as he pulled himself straight up. Soldiers below cheered them on. There were handholds aplenty, though he would never have wanted to do this without plate to propel his climb and protect him if he fell. It was still crazy. They'd end up surrounded. However, two shard-bearers could do amazing things when supporting one another. Besides, If they got overwhelmed, they could always jump off the cliff, assuming their plate was healthy enough to survive the fall. It was the sort of risky move that Adolin would never dare when his father was on the battlefield. He paused halfway up the cliff. Parshendi gathered on the edge of the tier above, preparing for them.
"You have a plan for getting a foothold up there?"
Yakimov asked, clinging to the rocks beside Adolin. Adolin nodded.
"Just be ready to support me."
"Sure."
Yakimov scanned the heights, face hidden behind his helm.
"What are you doing here, by the way?"
"I figured no army would turn away some shard-bearers who wanted to help."
"Shard-bearers? Plural?"
"Renarin is down below. Hopefully not fighting. He's surrounded by a large squad of soldiers with careful instructions not to let him get into the fighting. Father wanted him to see a few of these, though."
"I know what Dalinar is doing," Yakimov said. "He's trying to show a spirit of cooperation, trying to get the High Princess to stop being rivals. So he sends his shardbearers to help even when the run isn't his."
"Are you complaining?"
"Nope.
Let's see you make an opening up there. I'll need a moment to get the hammer out."
Adolin grinned inside his helmet, then continued climbing. Yakimov was a landlord and shardbearer under High Prince Royan, and a fairly good friend. It was important that light eyes like Yakimov saw Dalinar and Adolin actively working toward a better Alethkar. Perhaps a few episodes like this would show the value of a trustworthy alliance, instead of the backstabbing temporary coalition Satius represented. Adolin climbed farther, Yakimov close behind, until he was a dozen feet from the top. The Parshendi clustered there, hammers and maces at the ready, weapons for fighting a man in shard plate. A few farther down launched arrows, which bounced ineffectively off the plate.
"All right," Adolin thought, holding his hand to the side, clinging to the rocks with the other, and summoned his blade.
He slammed it directly into the rock wall with the flat of the blade facing upward. He climbed up beside the sword. Then he stepped onto the flat of the blade. Shard blades couldn't break. They could barely bend. So it held him. He suddenly had leverage and good footing. And so when he crouched down and leaped, the plate hurled him upward. As he passed the edge of the top tier, he grabbed the rock there, just beneath the feet of the Parshendi, and pulled on it to throw himself into the waiting foe. They broke off their singing as he smashed into them with the force of a boulder. He got his feet underneath him, mentally sending a summons to his blade, then slammed his shoulder into one group. He began to lay about himself with punches, smashing the chest of one Parshendi, then the head of another. The soldier's carapace armor cracked with sickening sounds, and the punches flung them backward, knocking some off the cliff. Adolin took a few hits on his forearms before his blade finally reformed in his hands. He swung about, so focused on holding his ground that he didn't notice Yakimov until the shardbearer in green fell in beside him, crushing Parshendi with his hammer.
"Thanks for tossing a platoon's worth of Parshendi down on my head," Yakimov called as he swung. "That was a wonderful surprise."
Adolin grinned, pointing.
"Chrysalis."
The top tier wasn't well populated, though more Parshendi were flooding up the incline. He and Yakimov had a direct path to the chrysalis, a hulking oblong boulder of brown and faint green. It was matted to the rocks with the same stuff that made up its shell. Adolin leaped over the twitching form of a Parshendi with dead legs and charged the chrysalis, Yakimov following at a clanking jog. Getting to a gem heart was tough. The chrysalises had skin like rock. But with a shard blade, it could be easy. They just had to kill the thing, then cut a hole so they could rip out the heart and... The chrysalis was already open.
"No!"
Adolin said, scrambling up to it, grabbing the sides of the hole and peering into the slushy violet interior. Chunks of carapace floated within the goop, and a conspicuous gap lay where the gem heart normally connected to veins and sinew. Adolin spun, searching across the top of the plateau. Yakimov clanked up and cursed.
"How did they get it out so quickly?"
"There." Nearby, Parshendi soldiers scattered, yelling in their impenetrable rhythmic language. Standing behind them, was a tall figure in silvery shard plate, a red cloak billowing out behind. The armor had peaked joints, ridges rising like the points on a crab's shell. The figure was easily 7 feet tall, the armor making him look massive, perhaps because it covered a Parshendi who had that carapace armor growing from his skin.
"It's him," Adolin said, running forward.
This was the one his father had fought on the tower, the only shard-bearer they'd seen among the Parshendi for weeks, maybe months. Perhaps the last one they had. The shard-bearer turned toward Adolin, gripping a large, uncut gemstone in his hand. It dripped ichor and plasma.
"Fight me!"
Adolin said. A group of Parshendi soldiers charged past the shard-bearer, running toward the long drop-off at the back of the formation, where the hill had been split down the center. The shard-bearer handed his gem heart to one of these charging men, then turned and watched them jump. They soared across the gap to land on the top of the other half of the hill, the one on the adjacent plateau. It still amazed Adolin that these Parshendi soldiers could leap chasms. He felt a fool as he realized that these heights were not a trap for them as they would be for humans. To them, a mountain split in half was just another chasm to leap. More and more of the Parshendi made the leap, flowing away from the humans below and jumping to safety. Adolin did spot one who stumbled as he leapt. The poor fellow screamed as he plummeted into the chasm. This was dangerous for them, but it was obviously less so than trying to fight off the humans. The shard-bearer remained. Adolin ignored the fleeing Parshendi, ignored Yakimov, who called for him to fall back, and ran up to that shard-bearer swinging his blade full force. The Parshendi raised his own blade, slapping aside Adolin's blow.
"You are the son, Adolin Kolin," the Parshendi said. "Your father, where is?"
Adolin froze in place. The words were in Alethi. Heavily accented, yes, but understandable. The shard-bearer slammed up his faceplate, and to Adolin's shock, there was no beard on that face. Didn't that make this a woman? Telling the difference with Parshendi was difficult for him. The vocal timbre was rough and low-pitched, though he supposed it could be feminine.
"I must needs speak to Dalinar," the woman said, stepping forward. "I met him one time, much long ago."
"You refused our every messenger," Adolin said, backing away, sword out. "Now you wish to speak with us?"
"That was long ago. Time does change."
Stormfather. Something inside of Adolin urged him to go in swinging, to batter this shard-bearer down and get some answers, win some shards. Fight. He was here to fight. His father's voice in the back of his mind held him at bay. Dalinar would want this chance. It could change the course of the entire war.
"He will want to contact you,"
Adolin said, taking a deep breath, shoving down the thrill of battle.
"How?" "We'll send messenger," the shard-bearer said. "Do not kill one who comes."
She raised her shard blade toward him in salute, then let it drop and dematerialize. She turned to charge toward the chasm and hurled herself across in a prodigious leap. Adolin pulled off his helm as he strode across the plateau. Surgeons saw to the wounded, while the Hale sat around in groups, drinking water and grousing about their failure. A rare mood hovered over the armies of Rohan and Ruthar this day. Usually, when the Alethi lost a plateau run, it was because the Parshendi pushed them back in a wild, scrambling retreat across bridges. It wasn't often that a run ended with the Alethi controlling the plateau, but with no gem heart to show for it. He released one gauntlet, the straps undoing themselves automatically at his will, then hooked it at his waist. He used a sweaty hand to push back sweatier hair. Now where had Renarin gotten to? There, on the staging plateau, sitting on a rock surrounded by guards. Adolin tromped across one of the bridges, raising a hand to Yakimov, who was removing his plate nearby. He'd want to ride back in comfort. Adolin jogged up to his brother, who sat on a boulder with his helm off, staring at the ground in front of him.
"Hey," Adolin said. "Ready to head back?"
Renara nodded.
"What happened?" Adolin asked.
Renarin continued staring at the ground. Finally, one of the bridgeman guards, a compact man with silvering hair, nodded his head to the side. Adolin walked with him a short distance away.
"A group of shellheads tried to seize one of the bridges, Bright Lord," the bridgeman said softly. "Bright Lord Renarin insisted on going to help. Sir, we tried hard to dissuade him. Then, when he got near and summoned his blade, he just kind of stood there. We got him away, sir, but he's been sitting on that rock ever since."
One of Renarin's fits.
"Thank you, soldier," Adolin said.
He walked back over and laid his ungauntleted hand on Renarin's shoulder.
"It's all right, Renarin. It happens."
Renarin shrugged again. Well, if he was in one of his moods, there was nothing to do but let him stew. The younger man would talk about it when he was ready. Adolin organized his 200 troops, then paid his respects to the High Princes. Neither seemed very grateful. In fact, Ruthar seemed convinced that Adolin and Yakimov's stunt had driven the Parshendi off with the gem heart, as if they wouldn't have withdrawn the moment they had it anyway. Idiot. Adolin smiled affably, regardless. Hopefully, Father was right, and the extended hand of fellowship would help. Personally, Adolin just wanted a chance at each of them in the dueling ring where he could teach them a little respect. On his way back to his army, he searched out Yakimov, who sat under a small pavilion having a cup of wine as he watched the rest of his army trudge back across the bridges. There were a lot of slumped shoulders and long faces. Yakimov gestured for his steward to get Adolin a cup of sparkling yellow wine. Adolin took it in his unarmored hand, though he didn't drink.
"That was quite nearly awesome," Yakimov said, staring out at the battle plateau.
From this lower vantage, it looked truly imposing with those three tiers.